Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Sarah Clark, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc webinar called New York, California, and the NLRA, the Future of American Labor Law. We're very pleased to welcome a terrific panel of legal experts today. Benjamin Sachs is the Kestenbaum Professor of Labor and Industry at Harvard Law School. He is also the Faculty Director of the Center for Labor and a Just Economy. Aaron Solom is a staff attorney at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. Our moderator, Alex McDonald, is a shareholder and the co-chair of the Workplace Policy Institute at Lilly Mendelsohn. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we'll turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Mr. McDonald, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
No, thank you, Sarah. That's a great introduction. And we really have a fascinating topic today, and this is no hyperbole, a truly excellent panel to discuss it. I actually can't think of two people who are better equipped to make us all smarter about the future of labor law and federalism and where we're going from here. Before I toss it to them, I thought it might be helpful to just set the table a little bit. As Sarah briefly mentioned, today's topic is broadly the future of labor law. Who owns it? Is it the states or is it the federal government? But more narrowly, it's about two specific laws, one from California, the other from New York. I think I'll start with New York's just because that one came first. So this is Senate Bill 8034, a New York law that authorized the state agency, the Public Employment Relations Board, or as the folks who practice before usually call it, the PERB, to take jurisdiction over certain unfair labor practices and union election petitions, union representation petitions, unless the NLRB, and this is the words of the statute, successfully asserts jurisdiction. And it seemed to call for the NLRB to actually intervene judicially, file a lawsuit, and oust the PERB before the PERB would lose jurisdiction over these particular matters. And then California, the law AB 288 gave a different state agency, but confusingly also called the PERB, jurisdiction over a variety of classes of employees and employers and workplaces who were otherwise subject to the jurisdiction of the NLRB under the NLRA. And, you know, there's a lot of categories within the statute. I won't spend a whole lot of time at the front end talking about them. But just to give you a flavor of what this looked like, the statute allowed the PERB to take jurisdiction over a case if the NLRB took too long to process it. So, for example, you go and you file an unfair labor practice charge with the NLRB doesn't do anything with it for 6 months. You can then, if you're in one of these covered employees, you can walk across the street, file a charge with the PERB, and the PERB would then have jurisdiction. So somebody coming to this issue fresh and not having been pickling in labor law for decades, like the folks on this panel, might think that this wasn't all that exceptional. We have a lot of state and federal agencies with overlapping jurisdiction. Just to stay within the labor and employment realm, you could think of all the state civil rights agencies that have overlapping jurisdiction with the EEOC. So that in and of itself isn't exceptional. But in labor law, it is exceptional. Since at least I started practicing labor law, and I think it's fair to describe it as something like a generation, courts have interpreted the National Labor Relations Act, the fundamental labor law of the United States, as comprehensive and exclusive And that means that it excludes not only directly conflicting state laws, which is a standard, straightforward conflict preemption analysis, but even laws that are consistent, that are covering the same subjects and maybe go a little bit further. In fact, the courts have interpreted the NLRA to exclude even laws that regulate areas where the NLRA arguably applies. This is sort of a prophylactic rule developed in a case called Garmin from the late 1950s. The whole idea was to protect the NLRB's quote-unquote primary jurisdiction to rule on issues before states and local courts and local agencies stepped in. As it has developed over the years, I think it's fair to describe it as one of the broadest preemption doctrines known to federal law. And so as these two state laws started going forward, many people, I'll raise my hand and say I was one of them, expected these laws to get tripped up under the Garmin Doctrine. And sure enough, they did. The Eastern District of New York enjoined New York from enforcing S-8034, and the Eastern District of California enjoined California from enforcing most of, and we'll talk about the most of part of AB-288. But without, I don't want to dive too much into the why and how much these still laws were enjoined. But what I want to do now is turn to the panel. I'll start with you, Professor Sachs, and I'll just ask you the big question. Did these two courts get it right? Should these laws have been enjoined under Garmin?
So thanks, Alex, and thanks for having me today. It's always a pleasure to join you for these discussions. And Aaron, looking forward to the conversation. My view is that at a basic fundamental level, the Supreme Court has always made clear that the essence of NLRA preemption, Garmin preemption, is a doctrine built around the exclusive competence of the federal agency to administer federal labor law. Preemption flows from the NLRB's role in administering our federal system. If you remove the NLRB from the system in whatever way, you remove the sort of fundamental justification for Garmin preemption. And in many ways, that's what happened over the last year. The board was deprived of a quorum for nearly a year, essentially couldn't operate. As a result, I think it was fair for states to come up with ways of filling in the gap left by the board. Now, the lack of a quorum is not the only thing that happened to the NLRB. Its independence was also threatened, is about to be undermined. And Congress, in designing the board, had in mind an independent agency. So when the court says we build a preemption doctrine around this particular federal agency, the particular federal agency it has in mind is an independent one. When you remove the independence of the board, you also undermine the justification for Garmin preemption. So that's at sort of the 30,000 foot level as a matter of basic sort of preemption theory. NLRA preemption is about the exclusive competence of the board. You remove the board from the system, you remove the justification for preemption. I want to say a couple things to anticipate a more detailed dive into these holdings. One thing that the court in California did was say the statute is not preempted with respect to cases where the board has been enjoined from acting. That may seem like a detail, but it's actually potentially quite significant. The theory of the district court is, as I've just laid out, if you don't have a board, you don't have a reason for Garmin preemption. And in cases where the board has been enjoined because of constitutional arguments, enjoined from acting, you don't have a board functioning and you don't have the reason for Garmin preemption. If we move in the direction of national injunctions against the agency operating, that will, under this district court decision, open up room for states to act without the threat of preemption.
Oh, that's a great setup. Aaron, I'm gonna give you a shot at the same question, just to start off broadly, whether these courts got it right. And I'd be interested in your response to something that Professor Sachs just said, which is the underlying rationale of preemption here, premised on the idea that we have a functioning board, a board that's active. Is that your understanding of the preemption doctrine? And how does that play out going forward with the you know, what some of us might describe as a detail, but I think, as Professor Sachs says, is very important, this idea that if the board is enjoined from acting, that California would be able to step in. So what's your reaction to that?
I have to take myself off mute first. Obviously, first, I want to say thank you to the Federalist Society and thank you to Professor Sachs for being here. This is already a great conversation, I think. But I think we just have a fundamental difference of what Garmin says and what Garmin's about. Because to me, Garmin isn't about the independence of the board. It's about a centralized national system in order to bring these claims to one kind of agency, not necessarily the character of the agency as it relates to its independence. And even if it was, I think Congress had already told, I think Congress has told us the answer of what wants to happen should the board's independence go away. And frankly, it probably already has. And so I want to get there, but that's getting like two steps ahead, because I think to really answer all these questions, you need to ask first, is Garmin preemption even right? And if it's right, like we said, is it still good law, like Professor Sachs was asking? And so Garmin, for the non-labor lawyers out there who are listening, it's a precedent that's, you know, it's really picked on, right? A couple terms ago, Justice Barrett called it unusual because it was so broad. Justice Thomas called it an oddity, and him and Justice Gorsuch signed on to a concurring opinion in a case called Glacier Northwest that said they were willing to look at overturning Garmin, possibly. States like New York and California have already kind of treated it as a dead letter, trying to pass these fill-in laws. But I don't think Garmin's dead, and I think there's significant value to Garmin, and I just don't think it's going to go away or be modified anytime soon. So I do think it's helpful to explain to everyone what Garmin was about. So Garmin was a case about a union that was picketing. A union wanted to represent employees at a company, and they wanted to have a forced membership clause, and the company said no. And so the union started picketing, and the company sued them in state court and said, well, your picket has caused us to lose business. And the state court awarded the employer $1,000 in damages. And the Supreme Court reversed because it said, well, the picketing is arguably protected or prohibited under federal law. It's not really clear which it is, but because it's arguable that this is somehow covered by the federal law, the state court was wrong to get involved. And so this is, like we said before, a very unusually broad regime, but the court had really good reasons for this, both textual and kind of out of the meaning of the NLRA. The court's members who decided Garmin grew up, you know, in a pre-NLRA era where strikes were widespread, sometimes violent, and state courts, on the other hand, would regularly enjoin strikes and collective action. And Frankfurter, who even wrote Garmin, wrote a book on labor injunctions and the court's use of labor injunctions to stop collective action. So you have a group of justices in Garmin who are skeptical of state court's motives. And then you give these judges a law that says, well, you can take this out of the state's hands. So, I mean, moving to whether or not Garmin is still good law because of changes in facts, well, I would say one is, you know, the argument that Garmin is no longer good law because of a loss of quorum, because nobody is, you know, because Trump fired a member of the board and because the board lost quorum. The board, for those who don't know, is a 5-member board. They, under the statute, they need 3 members to act. Well, I don't think that should change preemption, because Congress specifically in the statute said that the board lose, if the board loses quorum, it has no power to act. So the fact that the board can no longer act statutorily doesn't mean that its preemptive effect goes away, because Congress didn't want it to act when it had fewer members. And if preemption is really a matter of congressional intent, Congress made its intent clear. And I also want to point out that a quorum isn't necessarily a new thing. The board lost a quorum, for example, for 2 years between 2008 and 2010. And there was no argument at the time that somehow states could rush in and fill in the gap left by a board without a quorum. But I think that the bigger question is what does the loss of independence mean? As most people know, President Trump fired a member of the NLRB. The NLRA in itself contains a for-cause removal protection. It says board members cannot be removed except for a neglect of duty or malfeasance in office, and only after a notice and hearing. So it's kind of a big question of whether or not this is constitutional. The argument is that infringes, that restriction infringes upon the president's inherent Article II power to control the executive branch. But I would say that Garmin itself is not based on board independence. Like I am in preparing for the forum, I looked up and I read Garmin and I did like a, you know, control F and you search for the word independence. It's not there in the decision. You search for the word removal protections or removal protections. It's not in the decision. The removal protections in the statute 153A not even cited. The most that the court says is that the board has specialized knowledge and cumulative experience, but that's true whether or not members are removable at will. But if you read Garmin, what it is about is about the fact that Congress wanted a centralized administration with specially designed procedures, because it wanted a uniform application of the rules, because the pre-NLRA era, where states would regulate their own labor relations, led to too many strikes and it led to labor unrest. And I would also say that this runs into the problem of the severance provisions in the NLRA. The NLRA contains a provision itself that says if any portion of the National Labor Relations Act is ruled unconstitutional, that portion should be severed and the rest of the statute is to remain intact. And specifically, the NLRA says that if any part of the NLRA is struck down, that shall have no effect on any other portion of the statute. So if preemption is about congressional intent, I think it's clear that with the severance provision, Congress thought that if the removal restrictions were unconstitutional, that shouldn't change anything else about how the act is administered. And Congress told us so. So I've kind of filibustered for a long time. So we can throw it back to Professor Sachs to respond on how I'm wrong, or Alex. Yeah,
there's a whole lot there. Professor Sachs, I do want to ask you about a few points that Aaron made. So he made some points about Garmin itself and the structure of the statute. And I just wonder what your view is. Is the premise of Garmin so much about the board's independence? Is it about the active functioning, so the loss of the quorum, or is it about something else? Is it about an implied structure in the statute? And you know, the underlying court opinion, you make the point that, you know, it's necessarily implying that if we don't have a functioning board, in the case of, for example, an injunction, then California would be able to step in. How does that square with, you know, some of the points that Aaron has made, which is, you know, in the statute, Congress told us the board may sometimes lose a quorum, in which case the board wouldn't function. But there was nothing explicit, at least in the statute, that would suggest that the preemptive effect of the NLRA would stop at that point. So how do you?
Yeah, I agree. There's a lot there. So let me start with the last question you just asked. Congress said a lot of things about board and has structured the board in very particular ways. It's not clear that any of that has to do with a congressional view of preemption. So Congress hasn't said anything about preemption in federal labor law, essentially, not nothing, but very little. This is a court-made doctrine. The fact that that Congress, for example, provided that there will be a quorum of three suggests, yes, that if there's not three board members, the board won't operate. That doesn't imply that Congress thought that if the board couldn't operate, there should still be preemption. That's the logical leap that I don't follow. The other thing I say to Aaron's very thoughtful comments, Garmin may or may not be on the chopping block because of, you know, as he said, Justice Thomas in particular has indicated some misgivings about Garmin. I don't think that the arguments about these state trigger laws depends on a view that Garmin is no longer good law. I think the idea is that Garmin is good law. Garmin means that when there's a board, there's preemption. And that if there's not a board, there's not preemption. And there's a real question about what it means for there to be a board what goes into that. I think it's a very colorable argument that what it means to be the board is to be an independent agency. And I think that's colorable because I think that's the board that Congress intended. And there's, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about this Fourth Circuit opinion in a Merit Systems case where the Fourth Circuit said, what we look for in cases like this is whether the agency is functioning as Congress intended. If that's the right precedent, maybe it's not, but if that's the right precedent and it's cited in the California case, then the loss of independence is a reasonable reason to say we don't have the board Congress intended, therefore we don't have preemption as the Supreme Court interpreted it. All of these arguments about quorum, about independence are important, but they don't get us all the way home because, again, what's happening on the ground is that the circuit courts are hearing cases about enjoining the functioning of the agency. In the Fifth Circuit today, the NLRB is enjoined. That's not theoretical or hypothetical. It's the reality today. And that means that the California statute, were it enacted by a state in the Fifth Circuit, which is unlikely, it would be constitutional. It would be not enjoinable on preemption grounds. If we move in the direction of the Fifth Circuit, and I don't know if we will, but if we move in the direction of a nationwide injunction against the board's functioning, then states will have room to operate and will not need to rely on any arguments about quorum or independence to go forward. And so that to me seems to be the lay of the land. And just to sum up, I think there are strong arguments that if the president deprives the board of a quorum, that's a reason to relax preemption. If the president deprives the board of independence, that's a reason to relax preemption. If the board is enjoined from acting, that seems to me a pretty lock solid reason to hold that Garmin no longer applies in the jurisdiction where the board is enjoined.
If I could, I want to take a beat on this issue of independence, which we've all referred to a couple of times, but I think it's useful if we can to distinguish between the two, what people point to as the two threats to independence, because they are distinct. There are these constitutional challenges that have been filed against the removal protections for both board members and for administrative law judges at the board. And there is a separate set of cases pending right now involving the president's decision to remove certain independent agencies, some of which have reached the Supreme Court. Aaron, if you wouldn't mind just sort of taking a beat on that, explaining what these two threads are, because I know you've litigated actually in both threats. So if you could just tell our audience, like, what are we talking about when we're talking about these threats to the board's independence?
So the there's, like you said, there's two basic arguments that some people at the board have too much protection from presidential control. And it comes from the idea that these are Article II these are Article II principals or inferior principal officers or inferior officers. And so the main argument against the board member is that a board member has removal protections, like I said, in the statute, and that this infringes upon the president's ability to hold those principal officers accountable. Because we have a democratic system, you can't have bureaucrats making decisions or exercising the president's authority, his executive authority, without democratic accountability. And if there's no ability to fire them for a policy disagreement, there's no ability to hold them accountable. That's the basic argument. And that's the argument that was made in FTC members about Trump v. Slaughter. It's an argument that the Supreme Court had rejected about 100 years ago, 90 years ago, in a case called Humphrey's Executor. And the question is whether to overrule that. Now, there's some inferior officers at the board, and those are administrative law judges, and they are protected by multiple layers of what is called for-cause removal, because you cannot remove an ALJ under the Administrative Procedures Act except for good cause. The people who decide to remove the ALJ, which are board members, themselves can't be removed for good cause. And then the question of whether there was good cause goes to the Merit Service Protection Board, which its members also have for cause removal. So there's an argument that there that these multiple layers mean that you can't mean that the president can't exercise executive authority and control administrative law judges. Now, most famously, Elon Musk, SpaceX, owned by Elon Musk, sued the NLRB over these theories and a few other theories, and obtained an injunction, as a couple other employers also obtained injunctions in the Fifth Circuit. And, you know, I want to point out, though, that these are not permanent injunctions. These are preliminary injunctions that are designed to preserve the status quo of those cases until the removal protection issues can be resolved, because the court has said several times that appearing before somebody in other removal cases is a constitutional harm, and that you have a right to appear before politically accountable officials. And if those cases are adjudicated, you lose that right to appear before a politically accountable official, because, you know, once the ALJ trial is done and over, you know, the claim is essentially moot, because you don't have any right to reverse a substantive decision of an agency based on a removal protection, except in very, very rare circumstances under a case called Collins v. Yellen, where you can show that but for those removal protections, the officer's decision would have been different. So these are preliminary injunctions. They're not permanent injunctions. As soon as the removal protections are otherwise severed from either the NLRA or the APA, those cases can go forward. So I don't think it's a case where the sky is going to fall and that the NLRA is not going to be able to be enforced in the Fifth Circuit. So that's a long way to talk about the if you want a more in-depth version of this, you can look at one of my last forums, which talked about the SpaceX decision in the Fifth Circuit. But I think the outcome of all of these cases is it's not going to change anything, except if these corporations win, or if President Trump wins at the Supreme Court in Slaughter, is that the president will be able to fire a few more people at the NLRB. But it doesn't mean that the whole act is going to be stopped from being enforced in those areas, or in the Fifth Circuit permanently. Now, whether a permanent injunction is granted, I agree that could definitely change the calculus, right? Because if the NLRA is permanently enjoined, then, you know, the statute's been struck down. There's no preemption left. But I think that is a far more regular solution. And we could get back to this. Professor Sachs mentioned the Fourth Circuit's decision in Owen. In Owen, which dealt with the MSPB and I'm just blanking real quick on the statute.
The
Civil Service Reform Act. You know, there, I think we could get into a bigger discussion about that. I think that decision is very wrong, because what it essentially did is it said, well, we think Congress would have wrote the Civil Service Reform Act in a much, much different way had they known about the political situation that this is that has evolved 50 or 60 years after the statute was written. And therefore, we're going to rewrite it to allow for district court jurisdiction, which I think that's not a proper way to handle when a to handle when a part of the statute is unconstitutional. The correct answer is whether or not you sever that provision or whether you strike the entire statute down, not whether you rewrite it to fit your current view of how you would act as a legislator.
Professor Sykes, I do want to give you a chance to react to anything you heard about the description of the two, what I've described as these two tracks of the challenge of the board's independence. But also, I think we should circle back a little bit. You started your discussion about the specific decisions in this case, and I think the California decision is probably the more complicated and then probably the better place to spend a little bit of our time, because it did leave some avenues in place for the state to move forward. I mean, just for the audience, I mean, what was left in place after the California decision was that the state PERB can still take jurisdiction when the board is enjoined from acting, as we've talked a little bit about, when the board declines jurisdiction and when a worker loses coverage of the NLRA. And so I'm curious your thoughts on how significant any of those exceptions are in light of these challenges that are ongoing with the board and the decision on the other side of the country, which effectively knocked the entire New York State statute down.
Yeah.
So I know that's a lot to react to.
No, that's great. It's a great question. So again, the part of the holding that leaves in place the effect of the statute in cases where the board is enjoined from acting strikes me as highly relevant, given the moment we're in, where there are courts, including a circuit court, that are enjoining the board. I take Aaron's point that it's a preliminary injunction. And as with the quorum issue, these are not sort of permanent states of the world. I don't think live in a world where the board is enjoined forever. There is the severance possibility. I suppose it's possible that the whole statute will be struck down on some one of the constitutional theories that's kicking around, or will be enjoined. In the moment we're in today, the fact that the California court has said that California can go forward with its statute in cases where the board is enjoined from acting is relevant. The other piece worth pointing out, and this maybe bridges a little law policy divide, the court said that in cases where a worker is no longer subject to the NLRA, loses coverage under the NLRA, California has a right to apply its labor law to that worker, even though that's a private sector worker. That's not new. I mean, we basically know that with respect to workers who are not covered by the NLRA, there is no preemption. There are some fights about that, but that's basically the rule. But that's relevant. And I'll use an example of graduate students, which is an example close to home for me. There's been an ongoing contest at the board, and including in some rulemaking, about whether graduate student TAs and RAs are employees within the meaning of the act. Under existing law, they are. It's possible that the board will do something, that the Trump 2 board will do something either in an adjudicative or rulemaking posture that will remove graduate student TAs and RAs from the coverage of the act. And what this decision reminds us of is that will free states to enact labor laws or extend labor laws to those workers. So if you're an employer who employs graduate students and you're sort of looking at the possibility of the Trump board removing protection from those workers, what California says is if the federal government withdraws, we will step in and graduate student TAs and RAs will not be left without collective bargaining rights. Those collective bargaining rights will become a product of state law rather than federal law, but there will be no gap in coverage. And that's highly significant. It's not everybody by a long shot, but it is highly significant. It applies to, among other groups, gig drivers. I mean, there's an independent contractor question, but there are important sectors of the labor market that fit into this piece of the California court's opinion.
That's a great setup. Aaron, I want to turn to you a little bit and sort of just take a step back from the legal discussion we've been having. Why does this matter? So you represent workers day to day. I mean, what is the reason to worry if the NLRA's preemption doctrines are adjusted or if states have more leeway to regulate labor relations? What are the policy implications of that in your view?
Well, two things. First, I think, Garmin has really had a lot of overall, right? I could imagine a system where a world where Professor Sachs is correct, right? And suddenly we have Texas and Florida passing laws that I like for my clients, right? And so that could be good for them. But I think on the whole, though, Garmin has had really positive benefits because it's created like consistency. It's created predictability. It's allowed parties to know what law applies and when. And that if every state had its own labor regime, I think on the whole, things would get much, much worse, even if it would be, in my mind, be better in certain individual states. And I think you would have a breakdown and a return to, a possible pre-1935 world where you have disputes that are harder to avoid, disputes about which law to apply, and you'd return to, industrial strife. And the purpose, or at least one of the main purposes, not the only purpose, but one of the main purposes was, labor peace. I sound like a little like, Bill Murray and Ghostbusters, like there'll be cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria, right? I do want to go back to something Professor Sachs said, which is that Garmin is a court-made doctrine. And I just want to give like a bit of a textual defense of Garmin too, right? Because I think Congress thought it was passing a national law at the time to solve a national problem. If you look at the Senate report for the Wagner Act, it says Congress was giving the board exclusive jurisdiction over these questions. Congress has never responded to Garmin by lessening the jurisdiction of the board. And in that sense, it means Congress kind of has agreed that the Garmin preemption is far broader than normal preemption. It's been, 60 years since that we've had Garmin, and Congress hasn't done anything to modify it. But also the act, and this is mentioned before, the act does contain exceptions. And I tend to think one of those exceptions especially proves the rule. So under 10A of the act, the board can cede control over certain employees and employers to a state agency, but only as long as that law is consistent with the NLRA. And so if Garmin preemption wasn't textual, I just don't really think there'd be any real purpose for 10A, which already states the general rule of preemption. So if Garmin wasn't necessary, 10A, or if Garmin wasn't textually based, 10A wouldn't be necessary at all, because the state could already operate in this area as long as it was not inconsistent with the board.
Let me take the opportunity to agree with Aaron on what he said in answer to your first question. Which, and the agreement is that, in my view, and I take this to be Aaron's view, the optimal system is a federal one. The optimal system is one where we have a consistent labor policy for all 50 states. Where Aaron and I probably disagree is what that system ought to be. But optimally, we have a federal system. The problem, as I see it, is that what we have today is a dysfunctional federal system that preempts states from acting. So what we want is a functional federal system that's consistent and a positive functioning labor law regime across all 50 states. It seems to me the worst thing we can have is a federal system that doesn't work, that stops states from doing anything. And my fear is that we're sort of approaching, if we haven't already arrived at that world, the situation in the Fifth Circuit is like a little bit of an instantiation of the nightmare scenario, because you've got a federal law that's literally preempted, literally enjoined, while at the same time preempting states from acting. Okay. Given that we don't have a functional federal system, is it better to have to let states act? And, you know, to state the obvious, it depends on your view of what the best substantive labor law system is. But some states will do, by everyone's light, by some people's lights, good things, and some states will do bad things. And that's what happens when you don't have preemption. In my estimation, given how dysfunctional federal law has become, we're better off letting states experiment. By my lights, some states will do a lot of good things and some states will do bad things. Those are probably different states than for Aaron. But given how dysfunctional federal law has become, I would let states enact their own labor policies.
You know, I could just jump in real quick.
Sure.
I agree. The board is dysfunctional, but it has been dysfunctional for a very long time, and I don't think it has anything to do with the removal protections or being challenged suddenly. Mm-hmm. I think the common argument in this area, I'm not saying that this is Professor Sack's argument, but now that board members can be removed at will by the president, the board's just going to become a partisan institution and they're just going to do the president's bidding. My view is kind of like the board's never been quite as pure as Caesar's wife, right? There's, countless articles and studies on how the board is operated in a pretty partisan fashion, right? So, when Republicans control the board, they overturn, 30% of the precedents they don't like. When Democrats control the board, they overturn 30% of the precedents they don't like. And it whipsaws back and forth, but that's just a function of our democratic system. So, I agree. It would be nice to be stable, but I don't think that the removal protections are going to necessarily change anything about the board that isn't already true. And it's not a reason to overturn Garmin, because I don't think that's what Garmin was based on.
So, Aaron, can I ask you really quickly, because I just wanted to clarify this point. So there's a question of the removal protections, but removal protections are not equivalent to independence necessarily. I mean, I think that's often what people are talking about when they point to it, but it's not the only change we've had since Garmin. I mean, just very recently, we've had a executive order from the White House that suggests that formerly independent agencies now have to run the regulations through the White House. There's other directives toward independent agencies. So is your position that the change to the removal protections themselves don't affect the board's independence, or is it that independence doesn't really matter for Garmin preemption, or is it some mixture of both?
It's far more the latter. And the board, it's also helpful to think of the structure of the board. The board is a bifurcated agency, right? And so there's the general counsel on one side who oversees all of the board's regional offices. And then there's the board who adjudicates cases and hears representation appeals, and they pass regulations and they go for 10J injunctions, right? The general counsel has no removal protections in the statute. The general counsel has never had removal protections. Now, the general counsel has only been fired twice, once by President Biden and then once by President Trump, just most recently. But the president already controls the chief prosecutor for the agency. And they've always controlled the chief prosecutor for the agency, even if they didn't exercise that power. And so in that instance, I just don't see, when the president already controls the chief prosecutor and can choose who, already can say, well, we can prosecute this company, we can prosecute this company, right? Does board independence really matter? But I mean, that's kind of off to the side. I don't think Garmin is based on independence. Garmin is based on a centralized agency deciding these questions for the nation. And that doesn't change whether or not the president can remove somebody because he doesn't like a decision they made.
Yeah. Okay. Professor Sags, if you want, I want to give you a chance to respond to any of that. But if we can, you know, I would like to try to zoom back in a little bit, talk about these two decisions, and I'm going to ask you to make some predictive judgments about, you know, if we do see appeals in these cases, is there any chance, in your view, that one or both is reversed at the Court of Appeals level, or are we really thinking that if Garmin is going to be revisited, or if these decisions are going to go the other way for the states, it would have to be the U.S. Supreme Court that would do that?
It's a totally fair question. And I hesitate to sort of try to predict what any given court will do. As I said sort of earlier in our discussion, to me, there are very plausible arguments here, and some actually quite convincing, that given changes in the situation with respect to quorum, with respect to injunctions, with respect to independence, that the force of Garmin preemption no longer carries the day. And I can see a Court of Appeals saying that, and this goes to an exchange I had with Aaron earlier about, you know, whether Garmin is good law or not. I think that a Court of Appeals could determine that either of these statutes is not preempted, while holding that Garmin is still good law. And again, the way that they would do that would they would say, which is to me a legitimate reading of Garmin. Garmin says that when the board is operating as Congress intended, there's Garmin preemption. And so that implicit in the Garmin holding is, if the board is not operating as Congress intended, there is no Garmin preemption. That doesn't require the Supreme Court to reverse Garmin. Whether the Supreme Court will reverse Garmin, I have no idea. Aaron said it exactly right. There's indications that some justices are inclined to do that. Another question would be whether one of these trigger laws is the right vehicle to reverse Garmin. It may well not be, because they're sort of sui generis in a way.
Well, I certainly don't agree with the result. Like, if these cases were in the Fourth Circuit, I think they'd have a great chance of surviving under Owen. Now, I think Owen, like I said earlier, is a completely wrong decision, but it is the states who passed these laws were essentially following the Fourth Circuit's reasoning in Owen under a different statute, but it's very similar. Now, there's some differences between, you know, Owen wasn't a preemption case necessarily. It was talking about divesting district courts of the right to hear a claim for personnel actions for federal employees. But,
just to take a quick beat on that for the audience. I mean, so Owen was a case about the Civil Service Reform Act, which, as it's structured, requires federal employees of the federal government, to appeal certain personnel actions up through an administrative process that terminates with the MSPB and then can go to the federal circuit. The holding in Owen was, at that time, we had no functioning Merit Systems Protection Board, in part because of a loss of the quorum. And what the court did was it sent it back to the district court to reconsider whether or not the Civil Service Reform Act, which essentially is a forum selection procedure, requires these appeals to go up through a specific process to get to judicial review. The court was at least very skeptical that process was still in place, absent a quorum. And so the rationale here has been articulated, I think, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, Professor Sides, but by you and by others, is that, you know, the underlying rationale, even though it's not exactly the same issue, it's not necessarily a preemption case, is that when the statutory structure is premised on a functioning administrative agency, and that administrative agency goes away for whatever reason, stops functioning, then you have to question whether or not that was intended to be the exclusive way to resolve whatever issue it is that we're dealing with.
I think that's extremely well put, but I would tweak it a little bit, because Owen does talk about independence, and Owen does talk about the core of the analysis being whether the agency in question is able to function as Congress intended. You're absolutely right. Owen's not a preemption case, but the sort of the mode of analysis tracks pretty exactly to the mode of analysis in our context. And for Owen, for the Owen court, the question is the agency functioning as Congress intended? And if it's not, then there's reason to, in the Owen context, not remove the cases, and in the preemption context, not preempt. I want to take just 30 seconds to respond to something Aaron said in his last comment, because I agree. And this goes to the board losing independence? And Aaron makes the completely correct point that the NLRB has not been for a long time, if ever, nonpartisan. We can speak meaningfully of a Trump board or a Biden board or an Obama board or a Bush board because the NLRB takes on the policy predisposition of the appointing president. That is, as Aaron says, as it should be. That's by design. That's different than the kind of loss of independence that we may be about to see, where a board member can be fired for any reason at all. My sense is that the difference is that in the big cases like our captive audience meetings and unfair labor practice, you can predict the outcome based on the appointing president. But in the run-of-the-mill unfair labor practice case, which is like the great bulk of what the board does, the board does a pretty good job applying precedent, whether it's a Republican board or a Democratic board. In the run-of-the-mill cases, the board plays it pretty straight. That's what's threatened. That's threatened by the prospect that if you are a contributor to the president or an opponent of the president, that you're going to get differential treatment at the board, because the board members will be afraid that if they come out the wrong way, they'll be fired. And that's not just this president. That's any president. That's a change. And that's a change from kind of a partisan policy orientation to a kind of deeply politicized, captured board that really is different than what Congress had in mind. I want to stress again that these statutes do not live and die on the independence argument alone. There's a lot of ways to defend these statutes against preemption attack. But the independence argument, it seems to me, is a real one.
So I would just chime in, and I agree with a lot of what Professor Sachs says, is just to go back to that point of, independence in the small cases. I would say this is something that, has been bouncing around in these removal cases for over 100 years. If you go back and read Justice Taft's opinion in Myers, which is kind of the seminal removal case, and it really articulates, I think, the view of Article II unitary executive. Even he says in there, and President Taft has a very, very broad view of presidential power. He says, well, there may be some offices that are of adjudicative nature where parties have a right to receive due process, right? But then he goes on to say, well, the president can still fire them after the fact, and it may be like some kind of a due process violation. I do worry about that too, but I don't, that doesn't necessarily change my view on whether or not, removal is a good thing. But I would say that if the president is dictating in these cases, the result based on that, that may be a due process violation.
So that actually folds into another thing I wanted to ask about, staying with this theme of independence. We've talked a little bit and glanced at a couple of opinions that are likely coming this term. We've had two recent arguments involving the independence of other federal agencies. There's a Slaughter case, which involves a commissioner who was terminated from the FTC, and then the Cook case, which involves one of the members of the Fed. So, I think the broad prediction based on oral arguments in those two cases, and I'll stay with you for a second, Aaron, is that we're going to get a split decision there. just given the tone of the questions that were coming out. Likely, I think most people are predicting, you know, you run your own risk predicting based on oral argument. But the broad prediction is that the Slaughter case is going to go in favor of the president and the Cook case will not. Assuming that's right, and we get a split decision in these cases, what does that mean for the NLRB? Could a possible opinion in Cook upholding removal protections somehow translate to the NLRB? Or, and I'll anticipate a little bit, I think, or is it that because the board was designed in part based on a precedent that grew out of the FTC itself, that that's more likely to be the applicable precedent? I mean, do you have a view on that? I understand some of this is predicting. We haven't seen the opinions yet.
My predictions are worth what you pay for them.
Right.
I think that's right. I think the NLRB is likely to go the way that the Slaughter case goes, which deals with the FTC removal protections. The NLRB was designed, it's not a one-for-one copy of the FTC, but it was, Congress meant it to function like the FTC. And if they say FTC removal restrictions are unconstitutional, I think you'll likely see that. Either they'll deny cert in Wilcox's case, or she won't appeal, or they'll take it and say the exact same thing. Now, there's maybe some ways to differentiate it, but I don't think the court's going to accept any of those. The Cook one, obviously, the Federal Reserve is lots of people have made good faith efforts to differentiate the Federal Reserve based on history, tradition. Some people say that the Federal Reserve does not have an executive function, so it doesn't impede upon the executive's power, the president's power at all, because he can't fire a member of the Fed. Whether those are right or wrong, I don't know. I don't think Lisa Cook's going to win that one.
And we're running up against the clock. Professor Sachs, I think I'll close with you. I'll also ask you to make a predictive judgment again. And look, I understand, none of us have a crystal ball. But given where we are today, with all the various opinions we've talked about, now these two most recent district court decisions, is there any daylight for other states to move forward with laws like the laws California and New York tried to pass? Or are we really just in a holding pattern to see how these opinions are treated on appeal before, I'll just pick on somebody, before in Illinois or Washington State were to move forward with its own version of something like this?
Yeah, another great question. I mean, there are and there have always been things that states can do in the labor, the union organizing labor relations space, including for workers who are not covered by the NLRA. And I think we may see more movement in those areas, including for gig workers. So that's different than the question you asked. With respect to the type of laws that we've been talking about for the last hour, there is a new bill in Washington State that was just introduced that is much more, I would say, cautious on the preemption front than the others. It says, should federal law cease to preempt, then our law will go into effect. So that sort of avoids the questions about whether federal law does cease to preempt, but starts from the moment where there's some determination that federal law has stopped preempting. So it's more cautious, but I think there's a signal here, which is that states are, at least certain states are ready and eager to act, on behalf of work, private sector workers in their states, to the extent that they're, empowered to do so by preemption law. So I think there's like what we're seeing at a minimum is a significant appetite in the states for offering private sector workers a real labor law regime in the light of the federal system's failure.
Well, that's great. And we are at time. I do want to thank you both. This was a fantastic discussion. I learned a great deal. I hope our audience did too. And Sarah, I'll toss it to you if there's any closing statements from the Federalist Society.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Professor Sachs and Mr. Solemn for speaking with us today, and to Mr. McDonald for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise on this important topic. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can also stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, FODSA.org. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.